Okay, thank you, and Todd, for the kind of invitation. It is my great pleasure to give this talk, and I try to be make it as general as possible. So what I'm going to talk about is about the chronic genome sequencing, but not only the sequencing itself, but also the application of the sequence. You know, what kind of sequence, the quality of sequence, what kind of sequence we have right now, and how we can use it for mainly improved cotton production, in particular, you know, fiber quality or fiber development, as well as some of the devastating diseases and pathogens that we have to overcome for the cotton growers. So here's a list of my presentation in five areas, from sequencing technology, and all the way to the future directions and perspectives. So I want to give you a little interesting like historical background of this. So sequencing itself is kind of boring. So this is a quote from Sidney Brenner, who is really an advocate of human genome sequencing. At the early stage of human genome sequencing, what he said was, sequencing was so boring, it should be done by prisoners. But however, the impact of sequence is so huge in the society, you know, from all the way from the first genome sequencing of Arabopsis to the followed by human genome sequencing, rice, corn, panda, and wheat, and then cotton. But they all appeared in the high impact journals and has changed our way of thinking, doing genetics and breeding, as well as farming in agriculture. So what I would say, sequencing was so boring, it should be done by the machines. That's pretty much the revolution of the sequencing technology. You know, at the time of its human genome sequencing, as we know, it's done by the ABI machine. At the time when the sequencing cost can be as low as 1.1 cent per base, or 1 cent per base at a time, then it's possible to sequence the entire human genome of 3 billion base pairs. And then that cost gets down to the next generation sequencing, where the cost of per base sequence at a time is 1 millionth of a cent per base. Okay. So it's dramatic improvement of the sequencing technology and capabilities that can make a large genomes being sequenced relatively easily. And more recently, the third generation technology, or the single molecule sequencing technology, or real-time sequencing technology, that can sequence a human genome by de novo at the price tag of $1,000 to $3,000. So it really is the sequencing advancement is pretty much dependent on technology improvement. And the cost of sequencing is outpaced the Moore's law in terms of the, you know, the prediction of how much it will cost to sequence the genome. And this is based on the cost of sequencing human genome by NIH. And as a result, the cost of sequencing human genome at the beginning is pretty much around the price tag of $100 million, and to know it's only $1,000. Okay, and the number of sequences that are available now is from very, very few at the very beginning. Now it's, you know, all the projects involving 10,000 human genome sequences and 10,000 plant species all the way up. So this trend is continuing. And also the time involved in sequencing the human genome is really dramatically reduced. So this is a very old timetable. It would take about an average of 10 years for sequencing our Arabopsis genome and the human genome. To know it's only probably in a matter of a few days. Okay. So was that kind of a technology improvement then? We and several other groups have taken the approaches to sequence cotton genome. So what we are interested in sequencing cotton genome, not only because you know, for the fiber production and the cotton improvement, but also for understanding the origin and the cotton domestication of cotton species. From ancestral species that originated in the tropical and the subtropical areas, which are very photoperiod sensitive, to know day neutral cotton species that can be grown across the globe. And also the cotton is a tetrapod that was hybridized by two species that related, separated by evolution about 6-7 million years, and the hybridization happened about 1.5 or 2 million years, and that diverged into 5 or 6 related species, allotetrapod species, and only 2 of them domesticated. Okay, so one, as we know, domestic to upland cotton. The other one is domesticating to Pima cotton or Egyptian cotton. So that domestication occurred is estimated to be about 5,000 years ago. So you cannot cultivate the wild cotton species because they are photoperiod sensitive and they won't flower, say, in Texas or in Georgia. But the domestication process changed that day photoperiod sensitivity to day neutral trait. So some of those genomes, the question we would ask is why some of the species are domesticated where others are not domesticated, and many other related questions. So as I mentioned, cotton is a polyploid. So polyploid has kind of two kind of features. One is usually increase the cell and organism size. So this is a picture of the yeast from haploid, diploid, triploid to tetraploid. The cell size increases as the genome size increases. And then the other is basically hybridization introduce the hybrid vigor or heterosis. So many of the polyploid species, as what we know, wheat, cotton, and canola, they all are allotetrapods, and they show that growth vigor. Now, the reason for that is because the intergenetic interactions between the two genomes, okay, the two progenitor genomes A and D, like genome species, where that has been selected for certain better traits. In this particular case, you know, it's a fiber trait. So the tetrapod fiber is much better than the progenitor species. And that has a genetic basis and it has also epigenetic basis. In terms of gene expression, it's basically 1 + 1 = 2. So it's either larger than 2 or smaller than 2. Okay. Now, that phenomena is pretty much, I guess, happens to us as well. You know, in humans, we all have kids, but no kids are all alike. Okay, there's a lot of changes from the maternal genome, paternal genome, genetic interactions, epigenetic interactions, not based on DNA sequence itself. So those kind of changes that we really need the genome to understand how these changes contributed to the phenotypic traits. So there's two components in it. One is the genome sequence itself, in other words, the DNA sequence. The other one is a modification of the DNA sequence, that including DNA methylation, histone modifications, that changes the gene expression but not changes the DNA sequence itself. However, if the gene expression changes, then the phenotypes will be changed. Right? So it's a very important aspect of change that we need to understand. And that happens in cotton and many, many kind of traits. So the cotton genome sequencing really starts a journey from very early, I think about 15 years ago, that was discussed at very early stage of the ICGI workshop, probably in Nanjing at the time, seriously discussed. And then 5 years later, a group of us wrote on a white paper and still being based on by many groups in the community as a guidance for sequence cotton genome. And then 5 years later, we see at least 8 cotton genome sequences are released. Okay. So that includes three of the diploid species, the two versions of Lamangia genome, and then one version of the arboreal genome, and then two versions of the hirsutum genome or upland sequences, and then two versions of Pima sequences. Okay, so these are the Pima sequences, and these are the. So there's probably more to come if you keep tuned. You know, we'll see more and more coming. So I think most of those genome sequences are available in the Cardon gene database, right? So you can have a look and peek. So what I'm going to talk about, one of the genome sequencing, the upland Cardon, it's in collaboration with the international groups, notably Tianzhong Zhang's group at Nanjing Agricultural University and the Novel Gene Bioinformatics. So what we did is we sequenced the TMN sequence that is estimated genome size is 2.5 gigabases. And what we did is by a combination of approaches, including Illumina reads in the coverage of over 200 times genome equivalent, and then the mate pair reads, as well as the really gold standard, the Sanger sequence of the 175 back-end pair-end sequences. And then the sequence contigs were binged and partitioned by the SNPs that generated in F2 population. So we were able to order about 2 gigabases of a genome into different linkage groups. And if we look at the genetic loci, it's over 90 to 95%, or over 85 to 90% of genetic loci can be partitioned into both A or D homologs. Okay, so the sequence itself is of high quality. But I must say, like many other versions of sequence know in the database published, it's still very highly fragmented. So I will talk about this a little bit later. So from this genome sequencing, what we found is the A genome, as many of us know, A and D genome that evolve differently. In other words, A evolves faster, has a lot more changes, including some of translocations, as well as more TEs, more positively selected genes, and also more disrupted genes. Okay. Now, that actually has to do with some of the changes also at chromatin level. So in other words, this is an immunostaining of the one of the histone marks that for gene activity. So in other words, more staining, more gene activity. So the overall intensity of the markers in the A genome and D genome are similar, but then per unit in the D genome is higher because the D genome chromosome is 50% the size of the A genome. So in other words, you will see, you know, many of the genes in the D genome are more expressed. More genes are expressed from G genome than A genome. That's probably one of the reasons. So there seem to be some kind of asymmetrical changes at the genome sequence level as well as the chromatin modification level. So application of the Cardon genome sequences now has been readily applied into many, many areas of study, including genome-wide association studies, identification of QTLs, cloning of genes. This is only the partial list of the ongoing activities. Okay, many, many ongoing activities. And also some of the activities that we are doing on understanding the fiber cell development process. But there's more to come, you know, that such as gene editing as well as marker assisted selection for the important disease traits. So what I'm going to tell you a little bit more about the Cardon fiber development work that we are doing in the lab. As we know, Cardon fiber initiates from the protodermal cells on ovule and through 5 consecutive processes of development, early initiation to elongation to the late stage of maturation. And what we were interested in is the early stage of fiber cell initiation, because only a quarter to a third of protodermal cells develop into fibers. And if we can increase the number of fiber cells probably can increase the yield, as well as the process of elongation is very important, you know, for fiber quality. So what we found, there's two stages of development that are very different in terms of gene expression or like gene regulation. One is from the early stage of ovule development, in other words, from the protodermal cells in the ovule to the fiber cells. This one process of change in the regulates the gene expression is DNA methylation. That DNA methylation is induced by small RNAs. Now, in those genes that are induced by small RNAs was DNA methylation from ovule to fiber developmental stage, and those genes actually are positively associated with a high level of DNA methylation. And those genes include fiber-related genes such as MIP25 and some others that are known to affect fiber cell development. Okay. Now, in the late stage of fiber development, then those early, the genes activated in the early stages are more methylated by another pathway that is independent of the small RNAs, but dependent on another enzyme called CMT2, which is a gene that requires histone modification of histone H1 modification to initiate this process. And because of this additional DNA methylation pathway, those genes that are activated in the early stages will be turned off because they are no longer needed. Okay. So, as we know, the fiber is a very important trait in cotton. And luckily, there's a lot of mutants that are available. Here's one of them. It's a MD17. It's actually called a fibrous mutant. Both linked fiber and the fuzz fibers are gone. So, in our sequence analysis, we found that there's two kind of groups of MIP transcription factor genes that are related to fiber initiation process. One group of those is more related to the trachom or fiber development. This thing doesn't work very well. In those fibrous or linkedless fibrous mutant, those genes are still expressed, so their expression is not affected in the mutant. Where the another group of fiber-related MIP transcription factor genes, their expression is depressed in the fibrous mutants. So there's two groups of genes that control the fiber development in that process. So the next question we want to understand is, during evolution, what kind of changes at the genome structure and the genome modification, in particular DNA methylation, that affects the gene expression in cotton fiber? So what we found was interesting in a way that the phylogenetic tree constructed based on the rate of DNA methylation changes is consistent with the sequence, a phylogenetic tree that is constructed by the sequence, nucleotide sequence substitution rates, which means that there's concerted evolution between the DNA sequence evolution and DNA methylation. Okay. Now, but which means that they are not they are some relationship, but they are not exactly the same. So the rate of DNA methylation changes is faster than that of the sequence substitutions. So in other words, you know, the sequence and the methylation, that they go hand in hand, but perhaps reinforce each other during evolution. And one of the things that we want to understand during hybridization, whether the methylation changes induced can be maintained during polypolarization. Okay. So we look at the methylation changes, those changes. Sorry. I can't get an arrow to somehow. So as you can see, the second line is actually the hybrid, and then the rest of lines are different tetrapods. So many of the changes in the early stages are maintained. In other words, across all the different species. So those methylation changes are very stable. Unlike, you know, what we normally think, that methylation changes are probably unstable or can be reversed. They can be reversed, but during evolution, they are somehow stable, those side. Okay. So if you look at statistics, about, you know, 60 to up to 90% of those methylation changes can be stably inherited. All right. Now, those changes that are associated with genes, then we define them as epialleles. In other words, the genes that are associated with DNA methylation changes, we are defining as epialleles. Those epialleles, when you look at it, are more associated with domestication traits. A lot of, you know, stress response genes and all those kinds. And one of them, epialleles, is called consonant-like 2. You know, consonant-like 2 in consonants in Allobrogesis is a gene that regulates, a key regulator to regulate expression of FT, which leading to photoperiodic flowering. Okay. So what's interesting is that COL2 gene is an epiallele. In other words, in the wild cotton, it's highly methylated and not expressed. Okay. And then in the cultivated cotton, some methylation is lost and the gene is expressed. Okay. So if we look at all the cultivated ones, okay, the methylation is lost, the expression level is high. All the wild cultivars or wild relatives, the methylation level is very high and is expressed. So if that's the case, can we remove the methylation and to show the expression activation? So indeed, in wild cottons, if we reduce the methylation by a chemical treatment, and then the gene expression is increased. And in addition, if we use virus-induced gene silencing to inhibit expression of COL2, then we can delay flowering by about 10 days to 2 weeks. Okay. So suggesting that epialleles plays an important role in controlling the photoperiodic flowering. Now I'm going to tell you a little bit of like future direction, where we are going. Okay. So if we compare our genome sequencing to maps, you know, and don't give me some enlightenment about using the Columbus map versus Google map. Okay. Many years ago, Columbus, you know, used this map to navigate the world. But only he could understand and use that map. But now everyone can use this Google map, downloading, you know, iPhones and stuff. So it's pretty much, I mean, it's more very, you know, extreme comparison. But what we want to is to make our draft sequences right now, or as we call draft, to reference grade sequences. Okay. In other words, get where we are going to go. So what I mean, the sequence qualities, this is a comparison of sequence. So this is a sequence one. So the physical map is at the bottom and the sequence map at the top. As you can see, there's a lot of lines connected to somewhere from A to D genome, which means they are not correctly oriented. So in the ideal world, this line should be straight in the dashed line. But you can see some of these lines, you know, it's some kind of a line, but there's a lot of, you know, misalignment. So that's where, if you are want to look for genes there, then you will go there, but actually it should be somewhere in here, right? And this is another version of sequence, as you can see, the even less clear, you know, where you can look at it. So this is what we have in the current status of the cotton genome sequence. So as a step forward, we are using integrated approaches of whole genome sequencing by PacBio reads, as well as back-end sequences to refine the cotton genome to a level that it will be a reference grade quality. So this is a comparison of our previously published map, Okay. So the number of base pairs using PacBio, we gain about 20%. So in other words, in the previous published maps, 20% of genome is probably not accounted for, and now we can get back. As the number of contigs from thousands now to only a few hundreds. Okay. So it's a huge improvement in total sequence quality. And so in addition to the TM1, we also sequence some other tetraploids, and those are the number of, so this is one of the chromosomes. As you can see, the previously published maps has a lot more contigs compared to what we have now in our new sequences. And also the number of, the size of contigs is significantly increased. So by the way, the PacBio sequences of TM1 is now available as of April of last year at the JGI website. So then the challenges in colon genome sequencing. I think there's a lot of challenges. One is polyploidy because of redundant sequences, difficult to put them together. And the second is probably perhaps most important, but we really don't have a lot of money or funding to do functional analysis or further characterizing the genes and regulatory networks that is, we really needed to understand. As we know in Arabidopsis, when the sequence was finished, they had a follow-up project called the Tony Tang Project. Took them 10 years to understand better, not all of the genes. The goal was to understand the function of all of the genes, but it's not still far away from it. But anyway, but we probably should have discussions about, what we are going to move forward. And the other is that really compared to resources and genomic information, we have relatively poor support compared to other food crops, in particular maize and others. And transformation is rather difficult and time-consuming, as everyone knows. And so we also need to improve the research networks coordination among different groups, and then to enhance our bioinformatics resources. Calling gene is really a great way to start with. And we need to improving the genomic tools or readily applicable for the improvement of colon breeding. So one of the things that we are doing is actually the gene editing using the genome sequences, because this is I would call it one of the revolutionary technology. Even though it's using a gate RNA, but then the sequence changed is on DNA. So because the DNA sequence changes, and then everything from there will be inherited from one generation to another. Okay. So using that technology, we edited many of the fiber-related genes that we identified from our analysis to be in the transgenic plants. So that's in the process. So what I'm saying is that the sequence itself, even though it's boring, And to some extent, say you can say basic science, but it has a lot of ramifications for carbon breeding and industry as well as carbon improvement. And so with that, I'm going to stop and entertain a few questions if you may have. Thank you. Oh, I need to show this slide. This is I'm just talking the talk, but there's a lot of one of our collaborators and as well as groups at UT Austin, Nanjing Agriculture University, and the funding sources, in particular the Carling Incorporated, has provided a core project funding for over many, many years. Thank you.
If you have any questions, please.
Yes, actually, our sequence team asked me, like, Are you sure that you give us the different species of accounting for sequence? They look like alike. There are not a lot of variation. It's a short answer. It's very, very, very low level of variation. Yeah, I don't know exactly what happened there, but I think my suspicion is that once the two genomes are merged together, you know, they feel comfortable. So that somehow that, and also I think goes back to the origin of the tetraploid species. It seemed to be coming from the one single hybridization event. So from the same mother. And as far as we can tell from the crop path genome of all the species, that we sequenced the five of them, and they all the same. So it's very narrow genetic variation to begin with, you know, 1.5 million years ago, and that probably contributed to the narrow genetic variation among different tetraploid species that we have. But I don't know for the fact. It's just a guess. I guess this, you know, every one of us is thinking about that, why they are so different. Okay, if you say sequence variation is so low, right? So I think a lot of it is probably the related to domestication process of over, say, last 5,000 to 6,000 years because of selection pressure to make the fiber better and better. I would assume at the very beginning there's certain variation of fiber, you know, quality of fiber length. But then under huge selection pressure, the ones better getting better, right? So the other ones are not being selected and they keep as it is. But what is cause of it, we don't know. And hopefully, you know, in addition to the genetic variation that we are analyzing, we want to find, you know, the epialleles. Some of those could be epialleles. I think that's what we think, at least to based on some of our data.
Please give another round of applause.